You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, long gone are the days when fabric was made by a local spinster, that is, a woman who spins fiber into thread and thread into cloth. We consumers may have forgotten, but modern-day fiber artists continue to honor those skills of the past by embracing digital technology in their designs. We'll learn more from a museum exhibit here in Wisconsin coming up next.
First, a Legionnaires' disease outbreak in southeast Wisconsin has affected 11 patients since late October.
The cases all involve patients from University Hospital in Madison, which is operated by UW Health.
Officials think the cause may have been changes made to the hospital's water system, which could have allowed bacteria to grow. The hospital has treated the water system with a big dose of chlorine, and it says it looks like it solved the problem.
Megan Meller is an infection preventionist for Gunderson Health. Megan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what, first of all, is Legionnaires' disease?
Legionnaires' disease is caused by a bacterial infection. So it's caused by Legionella species that's pretty ubiquitous in the environment. You know, it's kind of everywhere in the water if you look for it.
And it's named Legionnaires' disease after a big outbreak, I think in the 1970s, right? When this gets into an air duct or water system, this can spread pretty quickly, right?
It can. I mean, we heard, I think there was a couple cases or a big outbreak this past summer and at Disneyland, and it was related back to the cooling towers.
And what are some of the symptoms of Legionnaires?
So Legionnaires' disease is essentially a pneumonia infection. So the main symptoms are going to be cough, shortness of breath, high fever, muscle pain, anything that you would typically see with pneumonia. But the thing with Legionnaires' disease is it's more common among people who are more immunosuppressed. So if I was exposed to Legionella bacteria, I wouldn't show any symptoms. I'd be, you know, I wouldn't have an infection. Most people wouldn't. But if you have some of these underlying immunoconditions, you're going through cancer treatment, have a transplant, you're going to be more at risk for actually developing full-blown Legionnaires' disease, having this pneumonia.
So this is something that, in particular, a healthcare facility, like a hospital, is going to be on the lookout for, right?
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why the government came out two summers ago asking for all large facilities to have a water management plan, because they were seeing cases in New York City. I know that was a kind of the epicenter initially of some of this stuff. Long-term care facilities, so nursing homes. A lot of these organizations are getting attention because you have patients who are going to be staying there for prolonged periods of time.
How common is it that we see an outbreak affecting multiple patients in a hospital, as we saw over the last week and a half?
It's pretty rare. I mean, Legionella cases are on the rise. You know, we're seeing that here in Wisconsin, and it's happening nationally, even out in the community. But, you know, things can happen, you know, and I don't want to comment too much on, you know, what happened, you know, at Madison and why it did not. But, you know, case in point is, you know, sometimes things just happen, but it's still pretty rare to see this happen within a healthcare facility.
Talking to Megan Meller, infection preventionist from Gunderson Health, talking about Legionnaires' disease and the, I think, never-ending battle against germs at healthcare facilities. Megan, can you talk about that wider battle? How are healthcare facilities around the state, around the country, on the lookout for these diseases that might be particularly dangerous for people who are already ill?
So one of the things we can do is just be very proactive. We already know it's out in the environment. We know it's in the city water. And so one of the things that Gunderson is doing and a lot of other hospitals are doing in the region are making, we call them, like, water management plans. So you're getting the right people around the table to have this discussion about the water. So it's getting your facilities guys around the table because they know where the water is coming in. They know how it's being treated. It's getting your infection preventionists on board because they can handle the patient side of things. And it's just kind of identifying what your high risk populations are and then what your high risk areas might be. So, like, do you have any water fixtures, you know, outdoor fixtures, indoor fixtures, things of that might pose a higher risk than, let's say, like a drinking fountain, which would be a pretty low risk.
Apart from Legionnaires, what are the infections that keep healthcare providers and infection preventionists awake at night that you're constantly vigilant for?
Influenza. You know, that's kind of what, for me, that's what keeps me up at night. I know after the season we had last year, it's definitely not something we want to repeat just because of how many people were being hospitalized. And we'd hear stories, you know, there was everything going out in California where they had to shut down ORs because they had to redirect some of that staff out to take care of patients suffering from influenza. And so, you know, that's definitely what keeps me up at night, but also the drug-resistant infections that we're seeing more and more of and higher frequency of, you know, it's just in the community. And when something is not responding to the treatment you have available for them, the antibiotics, and you can't keep up with the development of antibiotics, I mean, it's job security, but that's what keeps me up at night, are some of these things that are kind of beyond our control.
And you mentioned earlier, looking at the patient side of things, when you've got a population of people who are already ill for one reason or another, how do you have that early warning system to make sure, this is a symptom that is coming from a different cause than what they came in with?
Some of it is just making sure your providers are vigilant, too, so you know that they're doing the right testing. Like, so with Legionella, for example, we're seeing more cases, but we're also, part of that is because providers are now aware that it's, you know, out there and it's a possibility. So if a patient comes in with pneumonia, they might test that patient for Legionella right away rather than waiting, you know, 5-10 days into the hospitalization. So a lot of it is just increasing provider awareness about what different possibilities might be. And then we also just, we get lab results on a regular basis. So, you know, we can see, okay, patient was positive on this day of the hospital visit but was negative 4 days earlier. So what's going on? So we have these tools at our disposal where we can kind of monitor in real time what is going on. And that's what you could do, too, if there was a Legionella case. It's like, okay, what are the odds that this was acquired in the community versus acquired here within a clinic or hospital? And the CDC has kind of set definitions as to what would be classified as a hospital-associated versus a community. And so you can kind of use those case definitions to start your investigation.
Now, when it comes to something like Legionnaires, is it like every clinic for itself, or is there like a wider coordinated effort between clinics with healthcare agencies at the state and federal level?
There's more. So in some degrees, it is kind of every man for themselves. But like here at Gunderson, when we have affiliated hospitals, we are partnering with their staff to give them the tools that they need to be successful. So they can map out their water supply, but then we'll come in and consult, and we'll give them kind of our expertise to make sure that their plan is solid. So they definitely have the support system, and there is enough resources out there of facilities who have gone through this whole process before. Like the VA has already been through some of this when they had an outbreak at one of their facilities a couple years ago, and they developed a really solid plan. And so we were able to use their plan and kind of mimic ours off of that. So if you have your resources, you're not going at this alone. And the CDC has some really great resources, too, for hospitals just to get started at developing what a plan might look like for them.
Megan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Megan Meller. She's an infection preventionist for Gunderson Health. She was with us to talk about Legionnaires' disease after 11 people contracted it over the last 2 months at a hospital in Madison.
Coming up, you can get just about any image printed on a T-shirt thanks to the advancement of technology. But for fiber artists, the ability to print on fabrics has changed their game. We'll hear more about how the digital age has changed the work of some artists coming up. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, an analysis this spring showed that 7 of the 10 drunkest cities in America, including the top 4, are in Wisconsin. We'll find out what makes it difficult for governments to get a handle on problem drinking and the policies that have proven to work.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a traditional weaver.
Earlier this year, the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection implemented a statewide emerald ash borer quarantine. For April Stone, a black ash weaver and a member of the Ojibwe tribe, the quarantine comes with great consequences. Tressa Versteeg has the story.
My name is April Stone, and we're on the very southeast corner of the Bad River Indian Reservation in northern Wisconsin.
April is a black ash basket maker. She gets her materials from a nearby swamp. Harvesting the tree is a ritual.
Make the offering, say the prayer, cut the tree down, carry it out of the woods on your shoulders, put it in the car and drive it up the hill. Put it on my pounding station, which is in my backyard. When you're pounding a log, the pressure and the force of your pounder is disintegrating the spring ring, which is sitting just underneath that summer ring that you're pounding.
The summer layers peel off in long strips. Then they're spliced to the right width, and April weaves them into sturdy baskets that can hold just about anything. We go outside to see her latest creation, a burial basket.
So I guess, like, what's the process then?
Just making a big basket.
Yeah.
The coffin is 5 feet 7 inches long, woven for April's size. She says this burial basket isn't traditional to Ojibwe craft. Instead, the project is a statement about the emerald ash borer devastating black ash trees.
It's going to have a big impact on how I get resources and where I get them from. Right now, I go a quarter of a mile down the road and harvest from a swamp that I've been harvesting at for the last 20 years.
When April started weaving in the late 90s, ash trees were thriving in Wisconsin. There was no emerald ash borer, but there was also no sign of black ash basketry. So April taught herself to weave through books and museums.
And I contacted the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, and I was like, where's the native basket makers around here? And they're like, well, there really aren't any. That's when I started the search to, well, what's the history with ash basketry and why isn't it done now?
For years, April searched for a historical tie between black ash basketry and her community with no luck. It turns out she had proof all along. She shows me a black and white photo of a woman holding a young girl.
So this is my great grandma and my grandma. And there's the black ash 8x8 round work basket on the table behind them. And I was like, hey, look, there's a basket.
And how long had you had this photo before you noticed?
10 years. I don't even remember. I was just focused on the ladies in the picture. All I know is I love the fact that that is a black ash basket. And I think I know those people.
Another link is the Ojibwe language itself.
And I was told, like, Agimak is the Ojibwe word for ash, and it doesn't mean ash tree. It has to do with the properties of the wood and how it works.
April says it means a bending wood, like to make baskets or snowshoes. People knew how to use the wood.
They had a name for everything that grew from the earth, and that name was a very descriptive name that does not translate into English at all. It was a mindset. It's like the language connects people to the landscape because we are people of the woods. I have a direct connection just based on the fact that I make baskets.
Through teaching and workshops, April's worked to reconnect black ash basketry to the Ojibwe of northern Wisconsin.
It took time to educate people that, remember, we used to make these? But now they've quarantined the whole state of Wisconsin, and the emerald ash borer is going to be up here more easily. So this is the different context it's under now. Hey, our people wove with these, and guess what? The tree's dying. Yeah. You know?
April wove the first version of the burial basket in 2017 through the Native American Artist Residency Award for the Minnesota History Center in St. Paul. The basket, in its current form, will be on display at the center in 2019.
Tressa Versteeg is an independent producer with roots in the Midwest. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, as technology moves us along in many areas of our lives, from easy communication to being able to get just about anything delivered to your house with the click of a button, it's also changing something you might take for granted, things like our clothing.
A Wisconsin museum exhibit is highlighting the ways that technology is changing traditional fiber arts and crafts, from clothing to quilting and beyond.
Emily Schlemowitz is the exhibit curator at the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg. She joins to talk about their current exhibit called Fiber Arts in the Digital Age. Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Well, talk about what we mean by the phrase fiber arts. What kind of things does that include?
Yeah, sure. So fiber art encompasses anything from lace making to quilting to embroidery to rug hooking and weaving. It really is all around us. There's a long history of makers using natural and synthetic fibers to create works that can be both utilitarian, but also phenomenal works of art.
Yeah, that's what strikes me about this. This is something that might look really cool and you'd put it up on a wall, or it might also be practical and you could, say, wear it or use it as a quilt.
Exactly.
And we might think of all the things you just mentioned, embroidery, quilting, things like that, as kind of an older kind of thing, a traditional practice. But the point of this exhibit is people are using some of the most modern forms of digital technology. What kind of things are people doing?
Yeah, so sure. The exhibition was curated by our museum, and it really came out of a desire to feature contemporary working fiber artists who are integrating the latest technology into their studio practices. So we noticed that many fiber artists are really working at the intersection of art and technology, especially with the proliferation of handheld devices like smartphones and the advances made in printing technology. So digital printing is much more ubiquitous, and you can send, you know, a file out to Spoonflower, which is a digital printing company, and get back velvet or silk or any kind of cotton with your design on it. So it's really, really cool.
Right. That's pretty amazing, because I think of quilters. I know they go to a store, they look at the fabric available to them, they pick out something they like. In this case, though, the artist can say, I want a fabric that looks like this, and order it.
Exactly. Yeah, we're seeing a lot of artists working in Photoshop to create their own patterns, and then, you know, with a click of a button, they can send it out and then have it delivered to their home.
Now, walk us into this exhibit. What do we see when we come in?
So we see a lot of different kinds of arts. We have multimedia art. We have quilts. We have cyanotypes, which is a photography process. So we really try to curate many different kinds of fiber arts into the exhibition. There's a total of 15 artists in the exhibition, and each artist has contributed at least three works to illuminate how working with technology allows them to expand on an idea, a pattern, or design.
And how do these artists talk and think about the traditions of say, quilting and the other fiber arts that they're bringing forward into kind of a new era?
Yeah, so fiber artists have long been at the forefront of technology. And, you know, with the Industrial Revolution, we saw a whole host of innovations. And scholars have often commented that the Industrial Revolution moved thread production from the cottage to the factory. So I think that our artists are really cognizant of how they're working with digital technology. They're cognizant of the history, and they're really interested in pushing the media forward and innovating. And what's really cool is that they're innovating in their home studio. So really this technology allows them to be, you know, in a studio practice and really have access to a lot of different technology.
Can you tell us about a couple of the pieces that I know it would be hard to pick just a couple, but tell us about a couple of the pieces here and what they illustrate about technology and fiber arts.
Sure. So we have an artist, Becca Ron, who's actually from Minnesota, and she designs clothes. And she begins just by collaging different scraps of paper together. And when she's ready with the collage, she then scans it into Photoshop to make a repeating pattern. And once she's satisfied with that pattern, she sends the design off to Spoonflower. And then, you know, she's actually also written a book, I think, about Spoonflower. So she's very much like in tune with that kind of process. We also have another artist in the exhibition, Meredith Ray Grimsley from Pennsylvania, whose work also begins with a very painterly process. She makes figural work, mostly self-portraits, and starts with small watercolor paintings, which she photographs and then prints on a medium format HP printer in her home studio. To make her own photo transfer fabric, she uses an inkjet printer and a very accessible product called Bubble Jet Set, which is basically creates a stabilizing foundation so her fabric won't jam. So, you know, it's really about getting materials from the internet and then, you know, using a painterly process, but also really innovating with technology.
Are there ideas here that you could see maybe a home quilter or embroiderer or other, I guess, fiber craftsperson borrowing and being inspired by?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. There's another quilter, Jill Alt, and she makes these quilts. She takes one image, and then it's almost like she's tessellating them. So it's almost like she's looking through a kaleidoscope and just turning it a little bit and a little bit and a little bit. And so she creates this image where it's just a repeating pattern with slight variation. And that's just, you know, she's just doing it in Photoshop. So it's very accessible.
Can you tell us a little more about the museum itself, the Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts, and what's on display apart from the digital exhibit?
So the Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts was... We're in a barn gallery. We have a converted barn, which is really special. It's been retrofitted to be an exhibition space, and that really is our main gallery. So we have Fiber Arts in the Digital Age right now, and then in January we're going to be opening with Native Fiber, which will feature contemporary Native American art, fiber art. It's just a really special place. It's an old German farmstead that's been converted, and really beautiful grounds.
And we talked about what happens when we walk in the door of the Digital Age exhibit. What are you hoping people take away from it after their visit?
I hope that people take away how diverse and how phenomenal fiber artists are and what they're working with today. And it's just really, I hope that they see how striking these works are and how much, people really are innovating in their home studios, because I think that that's really key, is that technology allows them to do stuff, in ways that they don't have to go leave their home. They don't have to leave their studio.
Emily, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you so much.
Emily Schlemowitz is the exhibit curator at the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg. She joined us to talk about their current exhibit. It's called Fiber Arts in the Digital Age, how artists are using modern digital technology to create new and exciting works of art, quilting, embroidery, and more. That exhibit is open through January 13th.
Coming up, the CDC says alcohol causes 88,000 deaths each year in the U.S., Our guest tells us about some of the policies designed to save lives and what works and what doesn't. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. Remember, you can follow all of these conversations stream live at WPR.org or visit archives to check out some of the conversations you might have missed over the weeks and years. Also, you can use the WPR app to follow us on the Ideas Network as well. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, a lot of people create an online identity with social media, but what happens to our digital lives when we die? A guest tells us how to think ahead tomorrow morning at 6 on The Morning Show.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says alcohol is to blame for the deaths of 88,000 people annually, shortening the average life of those affected by about 30 years. Other studies show that since 2000, deaths linked to alcohol are up 35% to 50%.
Closer to home, an analysis this spring showed that 7 of the 10 drunkest cities in America, including the top 4, are here in Wisconsin.
A 2014 federal government study says stricter alcohol policies led to a decrease in binge drinking. But USA Today recently reported that legislative approaches don't always work.
David Jernigan is a professor in the Department of Health Law, Policy and Management at Boston University's School of Public Health. He specializes in alcohol policy. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, we heard some of the statistics there. How big a public health problem do you see alcohol consumption being?
Depending on how you count it, it's the third or fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. It is the number one drug still among young people. It's, somewhere around 4,300 deaths among kids every year. It's really both our most significant public health problem that gets the least attention.
Why does it get the least attention?
Well, we love alcohol. So many people like to drink, and in particular, so many people who are engaged in our political process like to drink. Alcohol consumption in this country, as well as worldwide, rises with income. And so the people writing the laws, this is the favored drug. Then alcohol companies, this is a $1.4 trillion industry worldwide, And the alcohol industry, as, you know, industries that large will do, spends an enormous amount of financial and other capital influencing legislatures, trying to push back regulation on alcohol and keep the most effective things that we could do in terms of prevention from happening.
Before we get into specific policy measures, is it possible to have somewhat of an alcohol-positive culture, the idea that it's okay to drink alcohol and, as the phrase goes, drink responsibly while still preventing the damage, the health damage, the accidents, the car crashes, and more that comes along with a heavy alcohol consumption?
It is absolutely possible. Take a country like France. In 1991, the French health minister declared alcohol to be their number one public health problem. They have reduced consumption across their population over the last 30 years by over 25%. They did some things like put in really, really strict restrictions on alcohol advertising, did things to discourage production of so much wine, and, you know, things have gotten better. It's a balance that has to be struck. And, you know, we're doing a better job in certain ways on tobacco these days than they are with alcohol. We never went the prohibition route with tobacco, and yet we've figured out how to keep it much better out of the hands of young people. We could learn a lot for alcohol from what we're doing with tobacco.
Talking to David Jernigan from the Boston University School of Public Health about alcohol as a public health problem. David, let's look at some of the different strategies. You mentioned cigarettes. Taxes on cigarettes were part of the story. Have we seen increases in alcohol taxes with the intent of lowering consumption? Are they effective?
Generally, we see the opposite happening with alcohol taxes. In the big tax cut that was passed at the federal level last year, there was an 18% cut for alcohol taxes at the federal level. Out in Wisconsin, where you all are, you have some of the lowest alcohol taxes in the country. The effect of this is a very bad message to young people because the drop in the taxes has made alcohol price competitive or cheaper than other kinds of liquid like milk, water, juice, and soda pop. We do have some examples of increasing the alcohol tax, and we've studied what happened to consequences. In Maryland, where I've just moved from, we added a 3% sales tax on alcohol in 2011, and we've done the careful studies. We found a small but significant drop in consumption. We also found a really significant drop in sexually transmitted diseases, and about a 6% drop in alcohol-impaired motorists on Maryland's roadways.
We put a question out to our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Logan says, ban advertisement of alcohol and pharmaceutical substances. We'll leave the pharmaceuticals aside. What is the impact of marketing, David, and do restrictions on marketing of alcohol work?
So we've got at least 25 studies that have followed groups of kids over time, measured their exposure to alcohol marketing and their drinking behavior at the outset and along the way. All those studies have found that the more that kids are exposed, at least, the more likely they are to start drinking. They're even more likely to progress from experimentation to more risky forms of drinking. So the evidence is pretty clear and substantial that alcohol marketing makes a difference in terms of kids' alcohol consumption. It's very difficult to do much at the national level to restrict alcohol marketing because of our strong protections for commercial speech under the First Amendment. That said, there are things that cities and states can do, particularly around reducing outdoor advertising, restricting retail advertising, just lots of things that, again, have been done in tobacco and could be done in alcohol. We suspect that they would, based on the research, that they would have similar good effects if we could do some of them in alcohol.
Are there communities in the United States that have tried banning that kind of advertising?
There are communities that have reduced it substantially. California passed a law at the state level restricting signage of any kind on the outside of a store to 30% of the windows, and said, and local cities can adopt something stricter. So a number of cities have adopted something stricter, 10%, 15%. What it kind of does is clean up whole neighborhoods almost overnight that are just literally plastered with signage for alcohol. The studies show that the more that kids grow up in neighborhoods like that, the more likely they are to start drinking at an underage, and also the more likely they are to say that they the neighborhood they live in are unsafe, even after we control for all sorts of other neighborhood factors.
We heard from Chris on Facebook. Chris says, this is what makes me nuts about Wisconsin's liquor law. I can't go into a store and buy it from 9 p.m. until 8 a.m., but I can go into a bar and consume it outside of those hours and hope not to get caught. This makes no sense except to the Tavern League. Chris says, let's talk about access. There's a lot of places to buy alcohol in a state like Wisconsin, I'll say. Does reducing access work to prevent problem drinking?
Absolutely. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control, when they, or the Community Guide, which is the big scientific body that advises CDC, when they looked at hours and days of sale, they found that any change 2 hours or more in any direction would have predictable effects on both alcohol consumption and alcohol problems. So that's hours and days of sale. Then the number of places, and this is particularly important in terms of the number of places that are selling for takeaway, for what we call off-premises consumption. We did a study in Baltimore City, found that for every additional outlet that was added to a census block group, you got 4% more violent crime. Now, on-premise outlets, bars and restaurants, they're important as well, but there's more supervision of the drinking in a bar or restaurant than there often is when people take it home, when they're drinking outside, whatever. So there's still a relationship there, but it's only about a 3% increase in violent crime if you add one of those outlets.
We're talking about efforts to fix America's deadly drinking problem with David Jernigan, professor in the Department of Health Law, Policy and Management at Boston University's School of Public Health. He specializes in alcohol policy.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to happen to fix America's alcohol problem? Is there a particular policy that you think would be successful? And how do you feel about raising taxes on alcohol, restricting sales, or improving access to treatment? That's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or ideas at WPR.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll pick up the conversation and hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. We're talking about America's drinking problem and some of the legislative approaches to fixing it. David Jernigan is our guest. He is a professor in the Department of Health Law, Policy, and Management at Boston University School of Public Health, who specializes in alcohol policy.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see done to combat alcohol abuse? How do you feel about the idea of higher alcohol taxes or limits on when and where you can get alcohol? What would you like to see in your community, in your state? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi, what do you think?
I'd like to see two things done. I'd like to see more ER doctors reporting it to the primary doctors, and the insurance companies paying for alcohol rehabilitation, and I'd like to see judges giving you more alcohol rehab in jails.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. A lot there. David, first of all, are ERs reporting all the alcohol-related cases coming into them and sharing them with primary care doctors, as she mentioned?
No, it's, you know, the data that we get out of the ERs is almost certainly an undercount. I've spent any number of weekends in ERs doing alcohol research. Alcohol puts a tremendous burden on the emergency room. If we could do a better job of collecting data there, it would add to the case for us needing to do more there. That said, the studies that have been done of alcohol in the ER found a significant increase over the last 6 to 8 years. People are not necessarily drinking more across the population, but there's a certain segment of the population that is drinking more and drinking in risky ways. In particular, women and young women seem to be catching up to men. This is a big concern because alcohol affects males and females differently, and a woman drinking at the same level as a man will have worse consequences.
And Mary Kay mentioned she'd like to see insurance companies and the court system do more to provide treatment for people dealing with a problem drinking. Do we have enough of that kind of treatment?
We don't have enough alcohol treatment resources. We could certainly do a better job there. And absolutely, treatment of all kinds behind bars is a big problem in this country. But that said, we will never treat our way out of this problem, and that's because the bulk of alcohol problems are not caused by people who would ever show up for treatment. The risk behavior with alcohol is drinking too much on a single occasion. We call that binge drinking. Surveys have found 92% of binge drinkers will never qualify for an alcohol dependence diagnosis. There are just so many more people who drink too much occasionally than the folks who are addicted. If we don't take population-level steps like increasing the price through taxation, like reducing the numbers of places and the hours and days in which people can get it, and like tackling the now ubiquitous, you know, advertising and marketing of alcohol, we're not going to make the progress that we need to make.
Back to our callers now. Eric is with us in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call. I wondered if your guest might comment on the ways that we as a society might nip this in the bud, if you will, in terms of maybe rethinking our legal drinking age to kind of take the stigma and the appeal out of it and make it more of a mainstream thing where kids maybe experience alcohol at an earlier age in better circumstance, like their parents' dining room, for example, and then maybe they don't have such a rush throughout it when they get.
Eric, we lost there, but I think we got the point. Lower the drinking age, bring kids into it more gradually, I think. And I've heard this argument from others, David. What do you think of that?
Yeah, a lot of people think that this is the way to solve things. Unfortunately, the research just doesn't support that. In fact, our drinking age is so much more protective of our young people than European countries that have lower drinking ages. We have the same surveys that are asked in the same setting with the same population, 15- and 16-year-old kids in schools in the U.S. and more than 30 European countries. When we ask them about drinking, our 10th graders are second from the bottom in terms of how likely they are to be drinking compared to the other European countries. The only one lower than us is Iceland, which has a drinking age of 20. So 21 absolutely saves lives. There's been so much research on this. And in fact, what is in the popular mind about this, that if we just integrate it into the household and, you know, let our kids drink in high school. In fact, the kids who have trouble in college drinking are generally not the ones who didn't drink in high school. They're the ones who started drinking in high school. We know this because we have long-term studies that have followed kids from high school through college, and we can show that trajectory. So I wish it were that simple. But in fact, we've done the opposite. We've let 21 sort of hang out there as the only significant thing that we're doing, or the main significant thing that we're doing around drinking. And we should be supporting 21 with other effective policies like higher taxes, restrictions on availability, and doing something about the advertising.
Eric, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Sarah with us in Green Bay. Sarah, hi.
Hi. Thank you for such an important program today. I appreciate especially the information you shared about marketing, including marketing to young people and children. One thing that I would like to recommend people consider is, you know, really to take a stand in our communities when it comes to public advertising of alcohol. For example, a lot of the area runs in this part of Wisconsin do encourage family participation and have running programs at our local schools. My family and I participate in many of these, and one of the runs in our area is sponsored by a major alcohol company and serves both alcohol and root beer to all the participants after the race in alcohol cups. I contacted the race organizers and urged them to stop, you know, being sponsored by an alcohol company. They didn't feel they were able to do that, but they did agree to stop serving the root beer in alcohol cups to the kids who participated in the run. So it's very normalized in our communities that alcohol will be a part of these events, and I think each of us needs to really step back, see how we can make an impact and say we're not going to stand for that.
Sarah, thanks for the call. David, what do you think about Sarah's story?
You know, it's a story that could be told over and over again in community after community in the U.S. I really salute people like Sarah who are raising their voices around this. So much and so much of the country, we have gotten the situation around alcohol that we have permitted to happen. The regulations on alcohol are steadily being chipped away at the same time that the marketing is entering almost every imaginable area of our lives and our children's lives. The Truth in Advertising group has just, you know, taken on Ciroc and P. Diddy because now they're using influencers in social media, and there's not even any credit being given, not even the advertising, the payment to these people isn't being exposed. That's a form of deceptive advertising to kids, and influencers are so important. Point being, yes, this stuff is so many places. The good side of that is that there are a lot of opportunities for people in local communities to learn more about this, to raise their voices, and to ask, why is this happening, and is this what we want our communities to look like?
Thanks for that call, Sarah. Brandy on Facebook says, Wisconsin has an alcohol problem. As with anything that's fun, there's a balance. You can't demonize it or people will rebel, but you can't make being wasted something that's cool either. So what do we do about our drinking culture, apart from the policy side of things, David?
Well, you know, culture is something that we create ourselves. We are humans. We spin the web of meaning that we live in. And advertising is an intentional process of cultural change. Policies are a reflection of culture. So I don't make the distinction between policy and culture. We use policy to shape cultural practices all the time. That said, the general message from public health around alcohol is less is better. Whatever people are drinking, less is better. Whatever amount of alcohol is being made available, less is going to be better. We could be much healthier around this product than we are. I think the caller's right. There is a balance to be struck, and we're way over on that balance right now.
And briefly, as we wrap up, David, do you feel like people out there, policymakers in particular, share your sense of urgency about alcohol as a public health issue?
You know, the general public supports all these policies. The policymakers, year after year, do very little in the direction of what's going to make a difference. It's a big problem we're facing, and I hope that more public voices can get engaged. Policymakers need to hear people around this.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
David Jernigan is a professor in the Department of Health Law, Policy, and Management at Boston University's School of Public Health. He specializes in alcohol policy. We talked to him about America's drinking problems and some of the policy approaches to reduce alcohol consumption.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there are growing calls for restorative justice in Wisconsin as an alternative to the prison system. We'll find out what it is, how it works, and which communities are already giving it a try.
And you may see more self-checkout lanes in your local stores. A guest tells us how self-check might influence the things we buy and how much we buy. That, plus a look at the news of the day, coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.